see my brother Pete is back. Good to see you, my brother. Yeah, I made it public now. It's always good to see you. As we come into the final session, I'm once again wanting to express my gratitude to both Pastor Paul and his dear wife Mia, and to each one of you for having me here at this time, and to be taking up all your Saturday. Now that's a big sacrifice. So thank you for allowing me to be here this day and to speak what is so much on the heart of the Lord. So let me land the plane. So we took off in session one. We went airborne in session two. Now let me land the plane in session three. Yeah, otherwise, you know, we are going to be circling the air. Let me land the plane. Now, because I am a seminary student, I've always been taught to be diligent in the work of the Lord. So I always do my homework. So the PowerPoints are just one example that I do my homework. To be diligent, I do my homework. What happens is, when I actually show up, the Spirit of the Lord takes me in a different direction. All right, now, it doesn't happen all the time, but it happens often enough. And I have learned not to rebel, not to resist, but to just flow with Him. And when I do, I feel a sense of freedom both within me, and I sense there's a blessing that I can leave behind. So it's not what I have to offer you that counts, it's what the Lord wants to put before you that counts. All right, so with that, give me the liberty to stray. All right, give me the liberty to stray, okay? So we are coming now to the last two letters of the word Israel. First session IS, second session RA. Now the third, the final session EL. And I like the word EL because it's L, that's God. And Israel cannot go on denying that her God is the God of Israel. She has the name attached to it. Like we have some Jewish people today who are trying very hard to hide their identity. They don't want to be known as Jews, especially here in Australia. But their name reveals their identity. You can't run far. Your name will reveal who you are. And so it is true with Israel. So let me see how I can fit a right word for E and then L. Because I'm detouring now. E, all right, let's say E. And for E, write the words, exalting the firstborn. Exalting the firstborn. So with that, allow me to come to what the Bible has to say to us. The Bible is exceptionally, extremely clear that Jesus is the firstborn. Time and time again, we see that in Romans, we see that in Colossians, we see that in Hebrews. And we see that in the book of Revelation, the writers of the New Testament keep reminding us that Jesus is the firstborn. Now, why do they do that? Why do you have to do that again and again and again and again? There's a certain principle that flows out of that. Remember, Jesus is the source of everything that is good. All right? Everything that is good comes from out of Jesus. So if Jesus is the firstborn, then I sense that in the first session I talked exclusively about Israel, and in the second session, I almost spoke exclusively about Australia. Now, in the third and the last session, let me go deeper on Australia. It has to do with Israel and Australia. Even as we are contemplating on the firstborn of heaven, there's a firstborn on earth. The firstborn on earth is, of course, Israel, my firstborn son. And that's what I spoke to you in the first session. But after hearing my brother Douglas, I have been to these mountains and met these tribes, these 12 tribes. They go by different names. One of them I remember is called Malay, M-A-L-A-Y, Malay. And I sense a kindred spirit whenever I with them. I don't know everything about them, but I do know something about them. And it's almost like what my brother Douglas had raised. Here in Australia, for Australia to come into her destiny, I mean the nation of Australia, you have a lot of Jewish people running around this country who are of the stock of the firstborn. Exodus 4:22, but they refused to be identified publicly as Jewish people. Last night was a good sample. Last night, after their meeting with in Dr. Shu's place, his colleague, David, Jewish, volunteered to drive me back to my hotel. So en route, we had a discussion. What did we talk about? Israel. And he began to lament over the fact that he, his wife, his extended family, would really like to hide the identity as Jews. Why? History. Given the history they have, it's not altogether popular to be identified as a Jewish person here in the land of Australia. And yet, of all the nations put together here in the Eastern Hemisphere, the largest firstborn are found here in Australia. There are Jews found in India, yes. There are Jews found in China, yes. There are Jews found in the Philippines, yes. There are Jews found in Indonesia, yes. No, Eastern Hemisphere. U.S. is a Western Hemisphere. All right? But Australia has the largest. I want to take you back to a time in history during the Holocaust. 1933, Hitler becomes the Chancellor of Germany. But you see, nothing happens, nothing in history happens, because history is really his story. Billy Graham was right when he labeled history as his story. So, the atrocities done to the Jewish people does not begin in 1937 when the Holocaust began. You have to go back to 1933 when Hitler becomes Chancellor, and then you have to go back to 1920, and then you have to go back to 1917. That's where it all began, 1917, the Balfour Declaration, Britain. So there is a redemptive gift that has been deposited in this land because Britain is a part of you. 1917, when the Balfour Declaration was declared that it was now legal for the Jews to return home to their homeland, the devil begins to get wind. What is this that I'm hearing? What is this that I'm hearing? I'm hearing the Jewish people are returning back to their homeland? What homeland? There is no Israel. There's been no Israel for 2,000 years. What are they talking about now? And the devil begins to get anxious. Is there going to be an Israel? Because he understands the stakes if Israel comes back. I told you this morning, the three reasons, right? So that's 1917. And then in 1920, 3 years after the Balfour Declaration, the League of Nations. The League of Nations is what we have as the United Nations now. The United Nations was born in 1947. But prior to that, it was the League of Nations that comprised of four Western powers and one Eastern power, Japan. Together they comprised the League of Nations. They came together and they ratified the Balfour Declaration, saying now it is legal for the Jews to return home. It's called the San Remo Treaty. All right, so when they had their commemoration, they invited me to be a part of that gathering, so I went. For no other reason, because of Israel, I went. And because nobody from the East would represent the gathering, I was not Japanese, but I like Japanese food, so I said, all right, I qualify. No, I went. So 1920, the second time the devil receives, first was an SMS, the second was a WhatsApp. What is this? Israel is popping up again. So afraid of what might the consequences be, the devil decides to anoint his chosen servant, Hitler. Adolf Hitler in 1933. So nothing happens in a vacuum. History is his story. And then in 1937, he begins what we call the Holocaust. Okay, 1937. That went on all the way up to 1939. Sorry, 1939 to 1945, 7 years. Sorry about that. 1939, 1945, 7 years. But in that year, 1937, when the Jews began to learn of their coming fate, that they're about to die, the Jews began to flee in different directions. Some fled west, some fled east. So in May 1939, there was a ship called the St. Louis, L-O-U-I-S, St. Louis, that carried 937 passengers, men, women, and children, they sailed out of Hamburg, Germany, bound for Cuba. They were given all rights to land upon arrival, but strangely, when the ship arrived at the harbor, they were told not to disembark and to leave the port, not knowing why. The kids were looking out of the windows. Why are we not disembarking? They didn't know why. And so they had to leave the port of call, and en route, they began to contact America. And Florida said, you can come. We'll give you safe refuge. But as the ship anchored, as the ship harbored in Florida, strangely, they said, no, not one of you must disembark, leave. From there, they sailed for Ottawa, Canada. Ottawa, Canada had given permission for the passengers of the St. Louis to land. But upon arrival, no. You can see how the devil works over time. He just doesn't want the Jewish people to live. Bottom line. Because every time the devil sees a Jewish man, that Jewish man reminds him of another Jewish man. You know who I'm talking about. That he has hated over the ages. He hates this Jewish person. And every Jewish man walking alive reminds him of this other Jewish man. He says, I hate you. Why? I haven't done anything to you. But you remind me of someone I know. So we don't understand the full diabolical nature of this battle. So finally, the ship with nowhere else to go came back to Hamburg. En route, UK picked up some. But most of them came back and they died. They walked right into the trap and they died. They died. This story was made into a movie called The Voyage of the Damned. Voyage of the Damned. And on the occasion of the Yom HaShoah, Yom HaShoah is the day that Israel remembers her dead, those who perished in the Holocaust. While the UN have chosen January 27 to be that day, Israel remembers that in April during the day of Yom HaShoah. It changes Yom HaShoah. And for years, I keep going to Israel because I needed to remind myself what happened to them. What happened to them? And that my ancestors, Christians, were indirectly responsible for this. And I had to come and stand in the gap and say sorry. I needed to repent. So I do this all the time. And that, incidentally, that's how I met Netanyahu. Because he comes. So while this was the story of the West for having rejected the Jewish people, some Jews fled this side. They chose to fled this side. Some fled to India, and India received them with open arms. Some fled to China, Shanghai. Shanghai received them with open arms. Some fled to the Philippines. More than 2,000 fled to the Philippines, and Philippines received them with open arms. But the majority fled here, Australia. And Australia received them. I don't know if you understand this analogy that I'm going to present before you. You know what a metal detector is? You know, sometimes you find these nuts, you know, in the beach. They have this thing that they go by the beach, and if there is a metal found hidden under the soil, it'll pick up the signal, and then they will just dig it up, and then they will pull the metal out. Could be coins, could be something else, whatever, all right? So it's a metal detector. So I imagine myself that as I pray, I take my place next to Jesus and I watch what Jesus is praying about and I pray about that. Prayer is agreeing with Jesus. Praying is not praying my agenda. Prayer is agreeing with Jesus. What is Jesus doing now? He's praying. That's what Hebrews tell me. If Jesus is praying, then I need to be praying what he is praying. I cannot be praying what I want to be praying. I need to pray. So I need to get beside him. I need to see what Jesus is praying. And then I pray the same thing. I agree with him. So one of these occasions, I found myself next to Jesus, and there was this like radar screen before Jesus. This is a vision, okay? I'm describing you a vision. I see a radar screen, and then right in the middle is Israel. Boop, 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 boop. And then occasionally, I see a nation that pops up, poop, 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 like on the radar screen. So when that happens, I know that I need to intercede for that nation. Right now, as I speak, the nation that is poop is Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka is turning 70 next year. So is Israel. There is something big in the heart of God for Sri Lanka. And I'm praying day and night as to what this is. So I see Sri Lanka going boop, and that's my signal to pray for that nation. Australia. Australia has been on the radar screen for a long time now. It's been beeping a long time. Because if Jesus is using a metal detector in the Eastern Hemisphere and is going around nations and trying to pick up a signal where my people are, where my Jewish people are, he goes to India, boop. He goes to China, boop. But if anyone comes to Australia, boom! And the machine dies. It's just too much. But the thing about the firstborn here is they don't want to be seen, heard, known. There's so much fear in their hearts, given the animosity of Christians in history. What happened last night was a lesson to me. I'm not an Australian, I'm a Singaporean. So I cannot fully identify with you with regard to the Jews. We have Jews. We have 3,000 Jews living in Singapore, but they are not residents there. They are, I mean, some are, not all. But we don't have your story. We don't know of Holocaust. During the Holocaust, some fled to Singapore. We don't have that. You have that. I don't have that. So last night at Dr. Shu's place, as we were driving off, I'm listening to this guy sharing his pain, that we are Jews, but we cannot say we are Jews. I didn't even bother to ask him why, because I know why. But last night, he felt for the first time comfortable to say we are Jews. He felt accepted in this company that was in his place last night. And I pray that there'll be more such fellowships throughout Australia who'll be able to convey that same message to the Jewish people in here in this land. Because right now they feel so very rejected, given their 1,000 years of history. Remember the wall with 1,000 bricks? There's just too much pain. Too much pain. And so for Australia to be lifted up, I imagine Australia, like in Exodus 17 and 18, where the Hebrews, having come out of Egypt, were en route to Mount Sinai, but the devil knows if I allow them to reach Mount Sinai, I'm done. Because God is going to reveal himself to the Jewish people in Mount Sinai and is going to give them his Torah and the blueprint for the tabernacle. If that's going to happen, I'm dead. I'm a dead dog. So before they arrive, just before they arrive, Mount Sinai, he ambushes them. And that's what we call the Battle of Rephidim. And as the battle ensues, Joshua is down in the valley battling. Moses is up on the hill praying. And we are told that as long as his hands were lifted up, there was victory in the valley. But the moment his hands got tired and started coming down, Joshua was losing the war. Two guys saw this, Aaron and Ur. So they come alongside by his right and his by left, and they lift up his arms till sunset, and the battle was decisively won, was over. The arms were lifted up. So I imagine, now I'm asking the Lord, so what needs to happen here in Australia for Australia to win this battle? And I feel that something must happen by the right, something needs to happen by the left. And I'm not talking about right-wing, left-wing politics. Okay, I'm talking about something spiritual needs to happen by the right and something spiritual needs to happen by the left. The first is to restore the firstborn here in Australia. There is a reason why these Jews have not made Aliyah and they are still living here. Given the fact that a large number of Jews are resident here in Australia gives Jesus enough reason to remember Australia, to look at Australia differently. Now, if my son is living in the UK, I may not feel the same about the U.S., but I definitely feel differently about U.K. And you ask me why? My son lives there. I'm attached. Someone I love lives there. So my feelings towards U.K. is not the same as it is with the U.S. And the same is true with Australia. A lot of his people are stuck here. They live here. And many have been born here, raised. Many have died here. And Jesus says, my sons are there. So his heart is towards Australia. I want you to understand that his heart is towards Australia because his sons are here. He cannot just bypass Australia. He cannot just bypass Australia. But something needs to happen here in Australia where Christians are able to communicate clearly, concisely, convincingly. We know who you are. And we honor you. We honor you as the firstborn. We need to communicate that clearly. So that's something that needs to happen on the right side of Australia if Australia is to win this battle. The firstborn in this land must be exalted, restored. By the left, the other firstborn in this land. Who am I talking about? The Aboriginals, the firstborn of this land. Now, strangely, the story of Israel is the story of all First Nations. You understand what I mean by First Nations, right? Like the Native Indians of America, yeah? The Inuits of Canada, they are the First Nations, okay? A striking similarity. Just as the firstborn, Israel, so are all firstborns throughout. Just listen to the story of every firstborn in every nation. Their story was written in blood. Without an exception, every story was written in blood. Here in Australia, there is a man called, I can't remember his name, but I think the ministry is called Cross, Southern Cross. Can't remember. Was trying to put things right with the First Nations. Here in Australia. And it has to do with Sydney. Sydney is where the whole thing is happening. Why is Sydney? I heard it was because of Botany Bay. Something happened here in your history. I don't know enough to comment on that, but I heard enough to know that Sydney is where it's happening, and it's happening in Botany Bay. And this is about repenting, reconciling, restoring the firstborn. So we need to understand these dynamics. Why are the firstborn of all nations suppressed? Because the firstborn is being suppressed, Israel. So here's the remedy. So what is God doing in our day and time? Slowly but surely, we see God lifting up Israel right before our eyes. Right before our eyes. Now, I don't know how you understand the book of Revelation, but I've read the book of Revelation 154 times. And my understanding of the book of Revelation, I submit to you, is to keep it simple. Simple for anyone to understand. It was meant to be simple. We have complicated that. The book of Revelation, besides the introduction and the conclusion, introduction 1 to 4, conclusion 20 to 22, everything else in between, Revelation 6 to or Revelation 4, 5 to all the way to Revelation 19 is all about three things. The seven seals, the seven trumpets, the seven bowls. This is the largest chunk in the entire corpus of the book of Revelation. So how do you understand this? The seven seals, the seven trumpet, and the seven bowl. How do you understand this? This is my understanding. As Jesus breaks the seven seals, he is unleashing the destiny of Israel. All right, so I want you to imagine Lazarus, the man who was loved by Jesus and then who died. But then Jesus came 3 days thereafter, and then summons Lazarus to come forth. And Lazarus comes forth with his grave clothes on. Now, the Bible doesn't say too much, but somebody either volunteered or was forced to volunteer to remove that grave clothes. Would you volunteer? So somebody went to volunteer. So in other words, before they saw Lazarus alive, they saw Lazarus dead but bound by grave clothes, somebody had to unwrap him. unwrap. And then I imagine they come to this part and his eyes is open. Okay, so they unwrap. So the unwrapping of Lazarus, dead Lazarus comes back to life. So as Jesus breaks the seven seals, it is a time when he unwraps Israel. He unwraps the grave clothes. And it is a time when he allows Israel to come into a destiny. That's how I understand the breaking of the seven seals is focused on one, Israel. Then as we move to Revelation 8 through 15, it's about the seven trumpets. What do we see in the seven trumpets? Seven trumpets is simply this: Jesus punishing the nations who had punished his people in the past. Jesus punishing the nations which had punished his people in the past. And where is that? Answer: Europe. Holocaust. Then we come to the seven bowls, or the seven plagues, as some would call it, Revelation 15 through 19. So what happens there? There, Jesus is punishing the nations that will be punishing his people in the future, namely the Middle East. So this is the sum total of the book of Revelation. Everything is about Israel. Everything is about Israel. Seven seals unleashing the destiny of Israel, unwrapping her. Seven trumpets punishing those who punished her in the past, and seven bowls punishing those who will punish her in the future, the Antichrist and all of that. So if you understand this, then you must understand something here, that right now God is in the business of restoring Israel. Okay, Israel is coming into a destiny, not immediately, like the grave clothes, one by one, Jesus is unloosing the bandages, removing the grave clothes. So Israel is coming slowly but surely into her destiny. I don't know if you ever heard this, but about a week ago, they made an announcement that the Jews are going to go back living in Judea Samaria, what the world calls the West Bank, and that soon 1 million people will take residence there. I don't know if you know the battle concerning Judea Samaria and the West Bank. Okay, as far as the world is concerned, that's the West Bank. As far as the Bible is concerned, that's the mountains of Israel, Judea Samaria. All right, Judea Samaria. So you have to ask yourself this question: why is the devil deploying his troops here in Judea Samaria? What's so interesting about Judea Samaria? When you ever tour Judea Samaria, you realize there's nothing much there. Just mountains and nothing else. Mountains and nothing else. Mountains and nothing else. And yet there are prophecies in Ezekiel 36 and 38. God speaking to the mountains of Israel, one day this will be a flourishing community. Now, the devil knows the future. So here's the future, my people. So as much as I want to understand what Jesus is doing, I want to know what the devil is doing. Sun Tzu, know what your enemy is up to. If I want to pray effectively and I want to strategize effectively, I need to know not only what Jesus is doing, but I tell Jesus, reveal to me what the enemy is doing. Show me what the enemy is doing. So what is this stronghold in Judea Samaria? So people try to understand that, and that's what my book is all about. In Acts 1 and verse 8, Jesus said, this gospel of the kingdom will go from Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, end of the earth. End of the earth. So if it went this way, it's coming back the same way, end of the earth. Samaria, Judea, Jerusalem. In the reverse order. So the devil knows that before the gospel can come wholesale into Israel and all the way up to Jerusalem and bring salvation to Israel, it has to come in through Samaria and then Judea and then. Read the book of Acts and you'll know for it. Which is why I have stationed myself in Judea Samaria. I have physically stationed myself in Judea Samaria. I have investments vested in Judea Samaria. I have money put into factories in Judea Samaria. The interesting is, I have an opportunity to share the good news of the gospel of the kingdom both to Jews and to Arabs. Because these factories are manned by Jews but worked by Arabs. And I have an opportunity to share this. So that's another story. But coming back, even as God is lifting up Israel, and that's what I want to see, if God is lifting up Israel now, the firstborn, then God must also lift up all firstborns. That's my point. Now, in the Chinese, they have a proverb. When the water rises, all the boats on the water rises as well. Have you heard of that? Yes? So when the water rises, when Israel rises, the firstborn, all the firstborn of the nation will rise as well. So this must be a parallel act. God cannot be lifting up the firstborn of Israel and not lift up the firstborn of the nations. So if God is doing this, he must be doing this as well. So my understanding of what God is doing in the nation is, right now as we speak, he's lifting up the firstborn of all nations. Which means that in your prayer, you have to engage the firstborn of this nation. The firstborn of this nation, because they are the firstborn of this nation. They are the ones who were here first. Now, before the land came to recognize the Ang Mo, before the land came to recognize the Chinese, the Malaysians, and the Singaporeans who came here, the land first recognized them. The whole idea of colonialism was to remove the land from the natives. Sin of 1,000 years. First 500 years, Portugal and Spain. The second 500 years, Britain and Netherlands. First 500 years, the Catholics. Second 500 years, the Protestants. You're ever wondering why the gospel of the kingdom became the gospel? Right here, colonialism. Because if I was a British missionary, and if I bring you the gospel of the kingdom, then I'm telling you, don't give up your land. But if I tell you the gospel without the kingdom, and I tell you your promised land is up there, then you relinquish your rights over this land. This was a conspiracy. I mean, it has taken us such a long time to learn this, but history. We learn from history. So coming back, the firstborn on this land. Over the years, I've been exposed to different parts of the Australian Aboriginal community. And wherever I go, it's the same story. They have sad songs by the rivers of Babylon. The sad songs. Not the happy ones, the sad songs. You know, when the Jewish people were exiled in the days of King Nebuchadnezzar, 70 years in a foreign land, they gathered by the rivers of Babylon and they sang sad songs. Today, the Aboriginals are singing sad songs. They call themselves a stolen generation. And irreparable damage was done in the name of God by missionaries who came here, taking away their children. Irreparable damage. So as we are coming to lay hold of the destiny of Australia, it's almost like you're laying hold of the horns of a bull. Not Turnbull, bull. Okay? Not Turnbull. All right, that bull has turned, but I'm talking about a bull. Okay, you must get hold of the horns. If you want to tame the animal, you have to lay hold of the horns. So here you have to lay hold of two horns, the firstborn. You have to lay hold of this. You have to come to terms with this, and you have to come to a place of repentance. You have to come to a place of repentance. How are you going to do this? I don't know. But in the 40 minutes that I have, let me tell you a story. Once upon a time, my Lord Jesus was in the mood for a story, so he spoke three stories in rapid fire succession. The lost coin, the lost sheep, and the lost son. Luke 15. Rapid fire. One after another. I don't know if you've ever taken time to meditate on Luke 15, but as I meditate on the first part of the story, it has a happy ending. The woman finds the coin. As she sweeps the whole house, she finds the coin. And at the end of the day, she begins to share that joy with the neighbors, and the whole neighborhood celebrates. Good ending. Second story, lost sheep. The shepherd goes out to look for the lost sheep, finds it, brings it home upon his shoulders, and he rejoices with his neighbors, I found the lost sheep. And the entire community rejoices. Happy ending. Third story, lost son. As you read that parable, the third and the last story, Luke 15, the story ends abruptly. The last thing you read about the story is the father is out in the bushes begging the elder son to come home. And the story ends. I don't know about you, but I was deeply disturbed by the story. And I said, Jesus, this story has a happy ending, and this story has a happy ending. This story does not have a happy ending. In fact, it does not have an ending. What's happening here, Jesus? This story 2,000 years ago, I wasn't even around. What do you mean? How do you want the story to end? Jesus said, how do you want the story to end? And that took me on a cycle of depression. Took me on a cycle of depression because I begin to see something that I never saw before. And the father is throwing a big party to announce to everyone else that the younger son has come back. Just like the lost coin, just like the lost sheep, just like the lost son, there is a party, there's a celebration. But the elder son, having returned from the fields, heard music and dancing. And he stood right where he was, he froze, and he summons one of his servants to come and say, what's going on? And the servant reports, your young brother has come home. Your younger brother has come home. And your father is giving a big party in his name. And then he refuses to move. The servant goes back to report to the father, your elder son is out there in the bushes. He refuses to come home. The father goes out, finds the son, begs the son, pleads the son, please come. The story ends. So I found myself in the position of the younger son. The situation in today's churches, where every Sunday is a celebration. We bring in the best speakers, we bring in the best musicians, every Sunday is a celebration. And for a while, our Heavenly Father is there. For a while, He's there. Then comes a moment, our Heavenly Father's heart turned towards the elder son. The father looks around and he says, I see my younger son all in celebration, but my elder son is not here. He's not part of the celebration. So the father goes out in search of the elder son. And I'm the younger son. So I keep walking around. I see every friend of mine has come to be a part of this party. And then I begin to take note. Where is my elder brother? I don't see him around. And then I say, by the way, where is my father? I don't see my father either. So I go to the first servant of the household. Let's name him Mordecai. Mordecai, have you seen my father? No, sir. No? No. I go to servant number two. Let's name him Hezekiah. Hezekiah, have you seen my father? No, sir, I have not. We go to the third and the last. Sir, have you seen my father? By this time, I'm getting a bit stressed out because this is a party and my father is not here and my brother is not here. And the third and the oldest servant in the household bows his head and says, young master, your father is out there in the bushes. Out there in the bushes? What is my father doing out there in the bushes? He should be down here in the house celebrating my return. Your father is out there, master. What is he doing out there? He's with your elder brother. My elder brother? Yes, your elder brother. What's he doing with my elder brother? He's begging him to come home. At that point, I realized, in that story, I had a choice. Now I became a part of the story. I was no longer someone reading a story. I'm now part of the story, and I realized that I had to make a choice. Do I continue with my celebration, Sunday after Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, go to church and have my celebration? Or will I have the courage and the conviction to leave the party and to walk out of my house and go in search of my father and my elder brother? I had a choice to make. and I made my choice. So imagine with me now, me, the younger son, walking out of the house, walking out of the celebration. Enough of this party. I don't want to party anymore. The two most important people in my life are not here. My father and my brother are not here. What is this party all about? So I walk out, I stage a walkout, and I walk in the direction of a certain conversation, a whisper that's going on in the distance. I try to follow, get myself in the direction where I'm hearing two voices. And then finally I get to the place, and I see my father begging with my elder brother, please come home, son. Please come. Please come home. And the elder brother is now angry with my father. And he says, look at my hands. All these years I slaved for you. I obeyed your every commandments, Torah. I obeyed your every commandments. What have you done for me? You haven't done a thing for me. But this son of yours, having wasted all of your inheritance and having plundered with his prostitutes, have come home and you gave him a part. And I'm hearing this. At this point, I have a choice. What do I do now? What, as the younger son, must I do now? If I want to get my father into the house, he will only come if the elder brother walks into the house. My father will never come into the house if the elder brother will not walk into the house. So I'm left with one option. I must get the elder brother home if I'm going to get my father into the house. So what do? I go and kneel before my elder brother. I kneel before my elder brother and I say, brother, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry for taking everything away from you and for replacing you. We are the church. You are Israel. I'm so sorry for all the damage that I've caused. I'm so sorry for having taken your place, replaced you. I am not the eldest son. You are. I am the second born. You are the firstborn of this household. I'm so very sorry, my brother. Please forgive me. Please forgive me. Please forgive me. And at that point, I began to see in my heart's eye the elder brother looking towards me. Me who was on my feet, on my knees. And I see his arms come around me. I was angry with you, younger brother, but not anymore. You are my brother. At that point, I turn and I see my father. I look at his face and I see something happen on the countenance of my father that I've never seen at any other time. The joy that comes into the heart of the father. As the story ends, sorry, it's a good ending. The father in the middle, elder son on the right, younger son on the left, we are walking towards the home. This vision has haunted me. It's haunted me all my life. And I realize that in no uncertain terms, the Lord has pulled my heart out, wrenched it, and has put this realization, what are you partying about? What are you partying about? And that's when I realize, oh my God. Because in Singapore, I don't know about Australia, in Singapore, it's all about a celebration on Sunday. Getting the big names, getting the big guys to come and sing. And it's a celebration. Yes, where's my father? Where's my elder brother? So should I go on? Or should I walk out and go in search of my elder brother? Because my father is out there. What's the point in all of this if my father is not at home and my father refuses to come until the elder brother comes home? So began my mission to our elder brother, the Jewish people. That's how it all began. But then as I was doing that, once I was in Australia, in a place called Alice Springs, you know where that is, right in the center of Australia. And it just so happened that at the center of Australia, where the heart of Australia is, he begins to say, but they are not the only firstborn, they are also the firstborn. And I was surrounded by the firstborns. What do I do? So I went on my knees. I'm not Aussie, but I'm the younger brother. So I went on my knees and I began to seek their forgiveness. These Aboriginal leaders would come from different parts of the Pacific Islands, including Australia. There was not one dry eye that day. But I realized I did something very right before God and man. And I say, you are the firstborn. Take your rightful place. Take your rightful place in the land of Australia. Soon thereafter, Kevin Rudd came into power. And for the start, he did something very right. But the devil was not. You understand? Like he took Guzdur away, the devil was, no, I'm not going to allow this. I'm not going to allow the firstborn of this nation to be restored to their rightful place. It's not enough to name this Parramatta, Kurong. Just name the streets after the, that does not do justice to them. They are the firstborn. At some point, the church in Australia needs to come to terms with this divine revelation. They are the firstborn. And they need to come in. They need to come in. So here we are, my people. So what do we do now? So I've given you three areas to pray about. Israel, Australia, and within Australia. In Taiwan, you listen to the stories of these 12 tribes. They have a very sad story. The Han Chinese came and displaced them. They had to go up the mountains. Did you meet a man called Pastor Lee, a tall man? And Joshua, of course, the leader of the troops here. See, because of my love for the firstborn, I have a love for the firstborn. You understand what I'm saying? Because I love that firstborn, but let me get it right. I love that firstborn. Who am I talking about? And because I love that firstborn, I love that firstborn, Israel. And because I love that firstborn, I love all firstborns. I recognize who they are. I recognize who they are in God's redemptive plan. And they need to be rightfully restored. So what are you going to do? I haven't the slightest clue. But the place to start is prayer. So when you begin to pray, pray not only for the... You have two firstborns in this land. The firstborns who were born and raised in this land, and then the firstborn who came into your land. Both these firstborns, the right and the left, needs to be lifted up. If Australia is going to win this war, I believe in changing policies, I believe in praying for the parliament, I believe in all of that. But at the end of the day, if you don't win the spiritual battles, you're not going to win the national battles. So Moses had to win the spiritual battle up there first before Joshua can win the battle down in the valley. So for you to see a victory, a grand victory come in the parliaments, something in the spiritual must be won first. The right and the left arm of Australia, the firstborn, the firstborn. The firstborn of Israel, and the firstborn of the land. They need to be recognized, they need to be received, and they need to be restored. I've never spoken this anywhere at any time in Australia. This is the first time I'm speaking this. And I realize that I'm speaking this because I am compelled by the Holy Spirit to speak. Like I said, I have done my homework. I could give you that, or I could give you this. I'm giving you this. Because this comes from heaven. So here are the keys to unlock the destiny of India, of Australia. The question is, are you going to step up? Are you going to step up? I realize you're not a mega church. So what? So what? When was the last time God needed numbers to do anything? Thank you, sir. 12? 120, that's all he needed to change the world. Never get sidetracked by numbers, because at some point the devil had whispered in our ears that if anything significant has to be done, it has to be by the mega churches. That's the biggest lie. God doesn't need numbers. 2 Chronicles 16 and verse 9. The eyes of God are scanning the earth to and fro, looking for a man and a woman whose heart is exceptionally loyal to God. When he finds one, he'll show himself strength on your behalf. That's all it matters, my people. The eyes of God are roaming the earth to and fro, looking for a man and a woman whose hearts are loyal to God. And when he finds such a man, such a woman, God can't help but show himself strong on their behalf. I'm one man, but I am an army. Don't mess with me. All right, you see me as one man. I've got 1,000 angels behind me. Don't mess with me. You got to take your place, my people. So if this prayer meeting, this is prayer gathering, Israel Prayer Summit, if it's going to amount to anything, it has to end up in serious prayer. Otherwise, it's just a conference, just a seminar. Frankly, understanding the spirit of this man and this woman, they are not into that. They are not into that. These people are serious. The more I hear this man speak, the more my heart is praising God for the revelation that God has given him. The more I hear that woman pray, I say, thank God. Thank God there are people in this land who have caught this revelation, received this revelation, and are willing to run with this revelation. You are in good company, my people. And this man could have been, but he chose to walk a different path, the road less traveled, Robert Frost. All because of what? All because of Israel. And that's the only thing. His gatherings are all about Israel. Why is God doing this? Because in the mega churches, our plates are full. As a pastor, our plates are full. You can't put any more in my plate. It's just full. Israel, sorry. Look at our plates. It's full. I don't have any space left for anything else. What do you do? What do you do? So you have to gather in groups like this who carry this fire in your hearts and come together to pray. This prayer can make a difference, always has. The great anthropologist Margaret Mead, I don't know if you know this lady, once said, anything that happened in the past, any great thing that ever happened in the past, happened through only small groups. Only through small groups. Not through big groups, small groups. So this is an outsider telling us, fight. I like what our pastor said. You Australians, when you pray, you don't pray like a Singaporean. Okay, we Singaporeans have a funny way of praying. So don't imitate us. You're Australians. You're light horsemen. In your prayers, charge. Never mind the odds against you. Charge! Never mind what the devil has lined up against you. Charge! That blood, that DNA is running in you. Israel remembers. 100 years after, Israel remembers. And people, does 100 years mean anything? Yes, 100 years means many things. But among the many things, the main thing that 100 years speaks to you about is, if 50 years is a jubilee, 100 years is a second jubilee. It is as if God said, you missed your first jubilee, now I'm giving you a second jubilee. Australia, come into your destiny! It's your second jubilee, and jubilee is that moment where we come into our destiny. This is your second jubilee. Not just 100 years in Bathsheba, remembering the past. God is saying in his own uncertain, his own way, I'm giving you a second jubilee. 100 years, 50 plus 50, 100 years. This is your jubilee. Come into your jubilee. Come into your jubilee. Now, do you want to let this moment pass you by? No, sir. No, sir. Grab hold of the horns and say, Australia, Turnbull, I'm turning this bull that way. It's being recorded, huh? Oh my, you better delete that. Okay, I'll leave that to y'all. Turn this bull around. Yeah, you know what does a bull do? Charge, right? So that's you, charge, but charge in the right direction. Yeah, don't charge against your family and your friend. Charge against the enemies. Turnbull is charging against his family and his friends. Turn him around. Put him on the other way. Okay, I think I should stop here. Pastor.